Londa agree to openness? While Raquel was extolling the virtues of self-confidence and empowerment, Yolanda called it a fair prevention. All that cake parading around. Surely, Doug's mouth will start to water. Chapter 18.
You're here!
Melody runs out to the car.
Sadie's gotten so big!
She's practically clawing the window to get at her grandchild. Melody power walks every day for hours to maintain her trim frame. Her short hair is dyed blonde, identical to her natural color before she went gray, and it's thinned in recent years until it's almost diaphanous, revealing a hint of scalp beneath. Scott is hanging back, framed by the front door. He's tall and equally trim. Bald on top, gray hair trimmed neatly along the sides, his head is shaped like a football helmet. He's in a polo shirt and khakis, same as he wore to work every day as an engineer. He's a creature of habit, not prone to sudden moves and disapproving of them in others. Now that I've got all those cake images dancing in my head, Tennyson as red velvet, Yolanda as lemon meringue, June as carrot, for the first time, I'm thinking we might just want to get the hell out of Dodge. The notes are scary in their way, but it's not the same way. Because with the notes, Doug is still standing beside me. We're still a solid team. The openness is a threat of an entirely different magnitude. It occurs to me that even if I convinced Doug to sell Crayola, his parents could prevent us. After all, Scott, Melody, and Doug are the only names on the deed. They told me it was better that way, since my student loan debt would have led to a higher interest rate. I don't know what would happen if Doug and his parents disagreed on something so huge. It's hard to imagine Doug really taking Scott on. I was such an idiot. I never even read through all the loan paperwork, let alone consulted my own attorney. I just let Doug and his family cut me out of Crayola. But trusting Doug so fully, so blindly, had felt like progress. I thought Dr. Morrison would have been proud. Crayola can still work out for us, if Doug and I stick together. We can opt out and find a different, non-swinging group of friends, and over time, the spreadsheet will just become a funny story. As usual, Scott and Melody's house instantly makes me feel confined. Trapped. It's an authentic Victorian reproduction. Melody doesn't realize the oxymoronic nature of that statement. Because it's mimicking the past, the rooms are all tiny and overstuffed. Heavy valances adorn every window, while small lamps and knick-knacks clutter every surface. The walls and furniture are all in somber shades like dark green and wine. Oil paintings depict dour-faced people in starched, suffocating collars from the turn of the century, except for the cherubs dancing in the master bedroom. The exterior is white with a gray shingled roof and a latticed porch and gate. A gardener comes once a week to do the prissy English gardening that comprises the small front and back yards. There's a carriage house to the side, Melody's taxonomy, not mine, that is basically a small studio apartment without a kitchen, and that's where Doug, Sadie, and I stay. The carriage house has an A-frame shape, but the wide double doors make it look like a barn. I like that we have our own place, which is essentially one open room, since the main house feels so claustrophobic. Melody has Sadie out of her car seat now and is clutching her tightly. Like Sadie is more doll than human. Doug has our suitcase, I have my breast pump tote, and we all caravan toward the house. Scott pinches one of Sadie's cheeks perfunctorily before slapping Doug on the back in a way that seems more fraternal than paternal. We're close enough to the coast, to Route 1, to be able to smell the ocean tang if we just open the windows. But Melody and Scott never do. The windows are shut and the curtains drawn in the living room. Doug and I sit on the couch, which is uncomfortable and covered in some sort of dark green velour or velvet upholstery. Whatever it is, it always feels slightly dusty to my fingertips, despite the vigorous cleaning I'm sure it had recently, courtesy of Melody or a cleaning woman. I don't think Melody would ever admit to paying someone to clean the house. All those years as what she called a homemaker have made her proprietary about all things domestic. That includes her monopolization of Sadie, which has already started. Melody has Sadie in her lap, turned around so they're nose to nose. It'll be 3 days of coochie-coochie-coo. "You're looking well, Katrina," Melody says, though she's not actually looking at me.
"I've been telling her that," Doug says. "She might believe it from an unbiased source."
Oh, his mother is plenty biased. Now, from his dad, I'd believe it. That's a man who doesn't dish out compliments lightly. It's funny how I used to like Melody so much more than Scott. I thought she had a sweet, gentle nature and got run over by Scott's alpha maleness. I've actually come to prefer Scott. He can be an asshole at times, but he is genuine. I think Melody manipulates Scott. Lets him be the bad guy and do her dirty work so she appears pure and sweet. Scott can be obnoxious, but Melody is wily. And Scott adores Melody. He never wants to see her upset in the slightest. If he feels we've done something, we'll face his wrath, which is formidable. And with Crayola at stake, it's a whole new level of walking on eggshells. Melody leans in to Sadie and does a loud sniff.
"Someone made a wee-wee in her diaper."
She looks over at Doug and me. "Shall I change her? It would be my pleasure." "Of course," I say. "Thank you." I keep seeing Yolanda's guarded face. No, not just guarded. Angry. I don't know what could have made her look like that. Maybe she and the others are lulling me into a false sense of security, and then they'll roast me on a spit at my own barbecue. They've all been writing the notes together, a team-building exercise for the block. How ironic that by wanting security for my family, I am the most insecure I've ever been in my life. Well, in my adult life, that is. Melody swans back into the room, Sadie in her arms.
Ta-da! All fresh and clean.
Sadie's beside herself, loving the undivided attention. I'm overdue for a pump. I whisper that to Doug.
"We're going to get set up in the carriage house," he announces.
"Can the little one stay with us?" Melody asks.
She bounces Sadie.
"Go on, tell them. Say, I want to stay with Grandma."
Sadie laughs. There's no refusing. I plant a kiss on Sadie's head as I follow Doug out to the carriage house. Melody stands in the doorway, waving Sadie's arm.
"Come back soon. We'll miss you."
The carriage house has pine floors, a closet with a moth-fighting cedar floor, and a brass bed in the center of the room. That's it. I find the minimalism refreshing in contrast with the main house. I get my breast pump set up and turn the dial. Doug putters around, hanging our clothes in the closet.
"Mom said she's hoping to have some time, just the two of you," he says.
It jars me a little when he calls her Mom, like she's my mom, too. Like Doug and I are suddenly siblings. Melody asked me to call her Mom at the rehearsal dinner, the day before Doug and I got married.
"You're my daughter now," she said,
holding me in a long embrace that smelled of powdery perfume. I hadn't yet realized her M.O. I thought she'd helped me plan the wedding. I didn't realize until afterward that she'd hijacked it. Everything was to her taste and specifications. While smothering me in words of support and love, she'd undermined me at every turn. She'd caused me to second-guess anything I liked with comments like,
"Your parents never had a wedding, did they?"
Or, "The nicest place in Haines is a Sheraton." In the end, she rendered me incapable of making a decision. Then she swooped in and made them for me.
"She's hoping the two of you can get closer," Doug adds.
I crane my neck to look at him. "Why?"
"What do you mean, why? You're her daughter-in-law. She loves you."
"She loves Sadie," he means. "She wants us up here every other weekend instead of once a month, but she hasn't yet laid down the law. Until now, it's been only hints. They like us on their turf, which was why I think they never argued for a guest room. That, and we were already way over budget just to get Crayola. Melody was the one who went to bat for the neighborhood, saying she'd never seen a better place to raise children. If only she knew. "Stop tensing up around my parents," Doug says, irritated. "They're not doing anything to you. My mother couldn't be nicer." There's nothing I can say. He'll never allow for the possibility that his mother's niceness is a veneer, that it's part of how she manipulates me. It occurs to me that Melody and I actually have more in common than either of us would care to admit. When it comes to Doug, we're both putting on acts. Chapter 19. Showering in the carriage house's clawfoot tub is no easy feat. The circumference of the tub is such that two thin white shower curtains are encircling and overlapping, and one always seems to be blowing in on me, wrapping itself around my leg like a cold, wet hand. I poke my head out to check on Sadie in her car seat. "You okay, little one?" Ugh, I must have heard that term of endearment from Melody 15 times yesterday before escaping to the privacy of the carriage house. Sadie smiles up at me. She's drunk on all the attention she's been receiving, not to mention a whopping 6 ounces of breast milk this morning. Being in Fort Bragg has increased her appetite. Must be the bracing sea air. She's still in her fleece sleep bag, her arms free to wave, but her legs zipped up soundly inside. As I watch her, she spits up a small bit of milk. She punctuates this with another smile, not remotely fazed by the unpredictability and mess of her bodily functions. I duck back behind the curtain. "I thought it would be good for me to get out of the AV, try to gain some perspective, but I just don't know." I keep the sing-song lilt in my voice, and I'm sure she's kicking her legs inside the sleep bag responsively. "I can't stop thinking about Yolanda and the notes and the openness, wondering how we can make the best of things. It might help to talk out my feelings, and I can't do it with Doug, who's up in the main house. Besides, running monologues are our thing, Sadie's and mine." "I'm glad you like it here, though. Your dad likes it, too. I'm the one who's out of step." I push the shower curtain back as it crowds me once more. "You probably don't know what I mean. I hope you never do. I hope you belong wherever you go. Not that you'll be a follower, that's no good either. But it's easier if you happen to feel the way the majority does. Like your daddy. He's the kind of person who's in step wherever he goes. Somehow, what he feels and what he does fit. If he had it his way, we'd be doing what everyone else is doing in the AV. We might even be on that spreadsheet. No, we don't see everything the same way. Take your grandmother, for example. He thinks she's this incredibly sweet, giving person. But really, being seen that way gives her power. It lets her control the people around her, and no one suspects. Sadie makes a delighted noise. "Exactly. Good girl. You just hold it together out there while Mommy finishes her shower, okay?" That happy noise can be the precursor to terrible things, a sign that she's close to an emotional edge. My heart speeds up a little, and I start conditioning madly. "Daddy thinks I'm resisting his mother because I've got Mommy baggage from my childhood. But the thing is, Sadie, your grandmother pretends she wants to be my mom because then she has license to run my life. Meanwhile, she's judging me all the time. She wants me to do things her way." Since Sadie hasn't made another peep, I decide to risk it. I apply shaving cream to my legs, striping them with the razor. Like last night. Every time I held you, her eyes were on me, appraising me, wanting me to hand you over to her again. She thinks I'm not good enough. But when she caught my eye, she'd give me this simpering smile. As if you and I were just the cutest things ever together. And when you started crying, and I walked you around and sang to you, she was at the ready like I needed backup. As I rinse my legs, I continue. I know it's better for you to believe the best about your grandmother. I just can't. Sometimes life is harder when you see things clearly. I turn the knobs to off and squeeze the excess water from my hair. A towel intrudes, attached to a hairy forearm.
Doug,
I say. I drop the towel in the tub and my heart drops along with it. He storms from the room. Naked, exposed in more ways than one, I race after him, pleading for him to understand.
Sadie won't remember anything. I was just thinking out loud, that's all. I don't even believe what I was saying.
Sadie is wailing at being left behind. Doug stops and stands dead still in the center of the room, his eyes cold. He's waiting for me. He wants me to see that look in his eyes, a look that says he could hate me. First the women of the AV, now Doug. Then he walks out, and I crumple to the floor. Vows aside, any couple's love is conditional. In a marriage, what's tied can be untied. My pretty life can be lost, just as I've always half feared. No, one look can't say all that. He was angry. There's no way he could mean that. He's my family. The only one I've got. Him and Sadie, he knows that. Maybe it's why he chose me. Maybe Melody isn't the only one whose seeming sweetness is actually power in disguise. Doug picked me because I was isolated, because I was malleable, just like Layton. That's only my past and the AV paranoia talking. Doug and I love each other. We both love Sadie. We're a family. Recent events aside, I know these things to be true. I steady myself enough to return to the bathroom. Sadie's eyes are wet, red, and accusing. She's asking how I could have left her. I'm sorry, baby. I wrap the discarded towel around myself, tucking it in, and lift her into my arms. I'm sorry, I tell her again. She bleats an extra few times and then drops her head against me, spent. I carry her into the room and climb into bed. Her body is so limp, so trusting. I wonder if I ever trusted my own mother this much, if she ever held me like this, or she just let me cry alone. I'm not going anywhere, I say into the top of her sweet-smelling head. I'll hold you as long as you need me. Longer. Within a few minutes, she's fast asleep, overdue for her morning nap. Doug will come back soon, and I'll apologize. I'll tell him I didn't mean a word of it, that it was temporary insanity brought on by stress and we'll be fine. He's always been convinced that my resistance to Melody is because of what I never got. Where Melody was supposedly buoyant and thrilled to parent Doug, my mother was perpetually sad and beaten down, paralyzed by depression. My grandmother probably should have raised me herself, but she didn't want to admit how bad off my mother was. So Grandma just covered for her. We scraped by on public assistance and my grandmother's handouts. My mother was unfit to be alive, let alone to parent. Doug thinks I don't know how to be a daughter because I didn't really have a mother. He might not be entirely wrong, but I'll tell him he's completely right. Melody is wonderful, and I'm the one with problems. I'll work hard to fix them and to accept Melody's love. I'll tell him whatever he needs to hear, because I can't lose him. I can't lose my family. I carefully lay Sadie down in the bed, surrounding her with pillows on either side so that she can't roll off. Not that she can roll yet, anyway, but you never know when a new skill will kick in. Better safe than sorry. Still in just my towel, I locate my phone. As I go to push the text icon, planning to beg Doug's forgiveness and tell him we can come to Fort Bragg every weekend if that's what it takes, I accidentally touch the camera instead. Then, I freeze. There on the screen is a picture of Wyatt and me. More specifically, it's Wyatt and me kissing passionately. I want to think it was doctored, but despite the darkness, the image remains clear. It would have to be the most perfect photoshopping ever, done on a very tight timeline. Who took that picture? Has Doug seen it? And what else could I have done that night to destroy my life that I have no recollection of? Chapter 20. Absolutely, I tell Melody. You push the stroller. I glance at Doug, hoping he'll notice how magnanimous I'm being toward his mother, praying he'll forgive me. It's two of my favorite things, the three of you and the gardens. Or are those four of my favorite things? Scott's the math whiz. Melody smiles, the fault lines of her face crinkling. She adjusts the brim of her enormous hat, its own solar system, though it's a mostly cloudy day. Practically every day is, this far north along the coast at this time of year. Doug smiles at her. Since he stared me down in the carriage house, he's ignored me. He blew off my repeated attempts to apologize. But being Doug, he ignores me in a way that escapes his parents' attention and thereby makes only me uncomfortable. He manages to be perpetually occupied elsewhere. For example, he's currently making sure Sadie's stroller is at the right height for Melody. In the time I've known him, I've never been this close to a breakdown. I'm using every trick Dr. Morrison ever taught me. I even tried to call her, but the number was disconnected, and when I searched for her online, all I found was old practice information. Dr. Morrison has gone out of business. Two therapy sessions for the price of one. Everything must go. Even the couch is for sale, and the soothing pictures of hydrangeas. Anyone need a lifetime's supply of tissues? I've deleted the photo, but that doesn't mean I'm in the clear. Whoever took the picture knows, and if that's the same person who wrote the notes, then I have no reason to believe they'd be discreet. Someone could tell Doug. He's been so angry lately. Is that because someone already told him? Of all the people to kiss in the alley behind Hound, somehow I picked Wyatt, Doug's best AV friend, and the husband of its most insecure woman. Or did Wyatt pick me? I just don't understand how it could have happened. I don't even remember Wyatt being at Hound. I thought it was girls' night. Ketamine. That's the only explanation. I would never have done that otherwise. I know that much. But would Doug understand if I revealed everything? Would he consider me a victim or think I brought this upon myself? For so many years, I blamed myself for inviting the monsters under my bed like I deserved it. I've tried so hard to believe that I deserve better, and Doug's a part of that. But if I would betray Doug with Wyatt so casually, maybe I was right all along. Doug's eyes are on Melody, who's in her element on this particular outing. She likes leading us around and seems to feel a pride of ownership in the gardens. She takes charge, striding ahead with Sadie. "You're going to love the rhododendrons," she says in a sing-song voice. I prefer to think her sing-song is more annoying than mine, but Sadie likes hers just as much. Because of Sadie's stroller, we have to keep to the main path. There's a formal lawn, but the vast swaths of rhododendron bushes along the rim have an untended vibe. Multiple blooms adorn each stem, often with prominent stamens, but the overall impression is still feminine. So conservative Melody loves a hermaphroditic flower. I'd laugh under other circumstances. The bushes of varying hues and heights seem anarchic, like they're threatening to come forward. They'll overtake that lawn someday, dammit. They'll defy the odds. I want to believe in the underdog right about now. I just love the colors, Melody says. Don't you? I really do. I try to infuse it with maximum feeling. I'll be your daughter now, Melody, because my family depends on it. Doug refuses to notice. He's pretending to admire the flowers. Doug, which color do you like best? I ask. He'll have to answer me. Engage or risk exposing our dirty laundry.
Which do you like, Mom?
He punts it to Melody, his eyes on her. He's tricky, that one. Like mother, like son. I'm beginning to despair.
The deep purple, right there.
She points and then walks in that direction, pushing the stroller onto the lawn, off-roading. She stumbles.
You okay, Mel?
Scott asks, instantly at her side. See, that's what love looks like, Douglas. Sometimes you have to hold each other up.
I'm fine.
She wipes at her white pants, as if she'd fallen, and laughs. I take the opportunity to walk over to Doug and weave my arm through his. He can't shrug me off in front of his parents.
I'm sorry, I whisper. For everything.
Might as well cover my bases.
I shouldn't have said those things to Sadie.
You were the one who said I haven't been myself.
I'm not going to talk about this,
he whispers back. His expression is thunderous as he steps away from me. Should I just be upfront about Wyatt and go ahead and confess? I could say I found the picture and have no memory of that part of the night, which is completely true. I just don't know if he'd believe me. He's so brutally cold right now. I can't imagine throwing myself on his mercy because he doesn't appear to have any. For all Melody's domesticity and supposed sweetness, I don't think she has any either. She's so full of judgment toward my mother, toward me. Oh, God. What if he tells his parents what I said? They'll want him to divorce me for sure. They can congratulate themselves for having kept me off the Crayola deed. Another woman, a stronger woman from a good family, would never have let them run the show like I did. I stride ahead to where Melody has parked Sadie in front of the deep purple rhododendrons. I need to continue my kill-her-with-kindness routine. Let me get Sadie out of the stroller, I tell Melody. Then you can walk her around and let her touch things. She loves that. Melody smiles at me. Doug's not falling for my act, but maybe she is.
That's a great idea, she says.
Sadie was just beginning to drowse, and she erupts when I unfasten and then lift her.
It's okay.
I toggle her up and down, feeling the rising panic that signals a tactical mistake on my part.
You're okay, honey. Nothing to worry about.
She disagrees heartily, and she wants everyone in the vicinity to know it. I feel my cheeks flushing.
Put her back in the stroller, Doug commands. She was happy there.
Now that she's out, she won't be happy to go in, I counter. I spend nearly every waking minute with her. I'm the one who'd know.
Can I take her? Melody asks.
I know that was the reason I removed Sadie from the stroller to begin with, but now it feels like handing her over would only confirm my inadequacy at comforting my own daughter. I have to pull this off. I just have to. I've got this, I say, treating it like an offer that can be refused.
Maybe she's hungry, Scott
says, loud enough to be heard over Sadie. It's his answer to everything. She just ate, I nearly shout back. I walk her away from everyone toward a spot in the center of the grass. I pat her back and hum. She's not letting me off the hook for this one, no chance. Her cries intensify. Doug and his parents watch and then whisper, like they're conferring on me, evaluating my fitness as a mother. I want to tell them it's not normally like this, that Sadie loves dancing cheek to cheek with me. Even Andy commented on just how bonded Sadie and I are. But we get around Doug's parents and I become the picture of fumbling ineptitude. How long has it been? 3 minutes? An hour? I hold her high up on my shoulder, supporting her with one arm, groping in the diaper bag with the other. Pay dirt. Her pacifier. I see Melody approaching me, and I think I've just got to get this pacifier in Sadie's mouth and shut her up. I've got a few more seconds. Furious, Sadie spits out the pacifier. It lands on top of the world's neatest grass, just propped up there like a diamond ring in a velvet box. Sadie is tantruming like a baby twice her age, older even. She's precocious. She's a prodigy.
You seem very stressed, Melody says to me.
I'm stressed because she's screaming. People are staring. I don't really mean the strangers, though a few are. I mean Melody and Scott and Doug, all three of them, conducting their referendum of me. I don't particularly care that Sadie is disturbing the tranquility of the surroundings. It's not like I brought her into a movie theater or to a meditation retreat. We're in nature, sort of. Nature's loud sometimes.
I think you've been stressed for a while, Melody says with exaggerated delicacy. Babies pick up on that.
It seems like she's implying that Sadie's tantrum is my fault, that it was brought on by my stress. She's actually blaming me, and a part of me thinks she's right. Melody has her sweet, grandmotherly expression on.
This might be a good time for me to hold her.
I can comfort my own child. She raises an eyebrow. Then she smiles and holds out her arms. I stare at her for a long minute, but she doesn't drop her arms. It's a Mexican standoff, and she's going to win. We both know it. Doug comes over, goes into the diaper bag, and removes a bottle of milk. Without a word, he snatches Sadie out of my arms, as if to say I've had my time, my chance, and I've failed. How easily he takes her from me. It shouldn't be that easy. He pops the bottle in Sadie's mouth, and she sucks gratefully. She's not hungry yet, I say, despite the evidence to the contrary. It hasn't been long enough.
Tell that to her, he says frostily.
He knows how I feel in front of his parents, how I worry about their scrutiny. I can't believe he'd show me up like this. He's punishing me. For what he overheard me saying about his mother, or for something else. Scott is standing by the rhododendron bush, like he's not with us. He hates a scene. Melody moves over to Doug and begins to stroke Sadie's hair. I've been blocked out, displaced. Before I can even think, I find myself fleeing across the lawn back to the path. I hear Melody calling to me, a note of bewilderment in her voice. I'm making it too easy for her, too easy for all of them. I look like a mother who fails to comfort her own child and then abandons her. But if I stay there, I will absolutely lose it. What would Melody say about me weeping in front of my baby? I fly past the heathers and the succulents and flowers and flowers and flowers, and the end of the path is like the end of everything. I'm high above the Pacific Ocean, overlooking the craggy bluffs, the sky gray and the water grayer. Its swirls are beautiful and menacing. Other visitors with their perfect children look at me with alarm or concern. A few seem like they're about to approach because an obviously distraught woman on top of a bluff isn't to be taken lightly. I should step back. Then there's a hand on my arm, and at the surprise, I feel myself stumble forward. Just a little, but enough to be frightening, and then that hand is yanking me back from the edge. It's Doug. I look at his face, and I don't see any anger there, only my own fear mirrored back to me. Then I'm sobbing, and his arms are around me.
I'm so sorry,
I say.
For everything.
Please know what everything means.
Please, Doug, just forgive me.
When he speaks, his voice is clogged with tears.
I'll try.
Chapter 21. You're going to snap one of these days. Anyone can see that. I wish I could say I was even a little surprised to see the latest welcome mat when Doug and I arrive home. Doug says,
"Let me take that."
And he goes to put the cardboard into the recycling.
"Don't even dignify it."
We can't just ignore this.
Wyatt said,
"Wyatt doesn't even know who's doing it." Doug shuts his mouth with effort. I know that in Doug's world, nothing goes too wrong. He has faith that nothing really ever will. That's why he can be so dismissive of this. but I know how cruel, how downright evil some people can be. I'm saving them, I say, in the back of the closet. It might be evidence.
Okay.
He hands it over and turns away. He wants to say more, but he doesn't dare. He's been treating me with kid gloves since that moment on the bluff. I keep thinking about what he said. When I begged forgiveness, he didn't say there was nothing to forgive. He said he'd try. Doug really thought I might have been contemplating a jump. I would disabuse him of the notion, but then he might just go back to his silent fury. So I'm playing along, being his fragile little invalid. I'm not entirely sure it's an act. Inside the house, there's no sign of an intruder. The rooms appear undisturbed. But then, I'm disturbed enough for all of us. I don't know what's worse, having kissed Wyatt or not being able to remember kissing him. Because it means I could have done other things I don't remember. What's strange is that only Yolanda seems outwardly standoffish toward me. At girls' night, they all emphasized the community of women, how they look after each other. It was a betrayal to kiss Wyatt before I'd opted into the spreadsheet. So is it possible the other women don't know? Or do they think it's okay for me to have a trial period to sample the wares? Then there's that conversation with Brandon. He didn't just talk about the spreadsheet in general. He specifically brought up Yolanda. So Yolanda must have confided in him, even if she didn't tell the others. I don't know if she sent him or if he came on his own, but now that I think about it, he was definitely trying to evoke my compassion for her. It makes me think of that song, Jolene. One woman begging another not to take her man. Brandon might think I really want Wyatt, when honestly, Wyatt had never even crossed my mind before. So why did I kiss him? I recall the next line of the song, about not taking him just because she can. Brandon and Yolanda might think I'm the kind of person who would be with Wyatt just for sport. It seems crazy that I could take anyone from Yolanda. She's so much prettier than I am. But from what everyone said at my recruitment, it's not about pretty, it's about new. New is the great equalizer. New is how we're all, as Raquel said, beautiful. At least Andy has resurfaced. She left a voicemail apologizing. I really did mean it when I said I'd be your sounding board. I want to be there for you, Kat. It's just been a truly crazy week. Join the club, Andy. I haven't called her back yet. I don't know who I can trust right now. I would have said I could trust Andy, but she was the person who talked to Doug alone and then disappeared. You're going to snap one of these days. Anyone can see that. For all I know, Andy wrote the notes. She's as likely as any of the others. Or as unlikely. I can't even tell anymore. But someone took that picture with my phone. Who would have done that except the writer of the notes, the person who wants me to snap? That means the writer was there that night. Either one of the women or one of their husbands. But I don't have a clue which one. And trying to parse a night that's only half remembered is exhausting. Not to mention that Doug and I are pretending things are normal. The charade wears on both of us. And give me the strength. We've got a barbecue to plan for next weekend. I want to cancel for myriad unspeakable reasons. But when I mentioned that possibility to Doug, he just stared at me, then rolled over and went to sleep without a word. It wasn't even 8 o'clock. Now he's at work, and I'm on my own with Sadie. She's whining so consistently in my ear that it's like tinnitus. I have to remind myself that love is sometimes a gauntlet to be run. Plastering a smile on my face, I elevate my voice an octave and declare, "It's bath time!" I hold her against my shoulder as I fill the blue plastic tub. She usually likes that part, watching the water that will soon submerge her, but not today. She stares at me, eyes wide with recrimination. Is she doubting my credibility, too? As I remove her onesie and then her diaper, she screws up her face and begins to scream. See, I tell her as she writhes on the bathroom floor. There's the water. You're about to have your bath. You love your bath. But she knows better. She does not love her bath. She has never loved her bath. I am a fool to believe otherwise. Shut up, shut up, shut up, I implore her. No, I order her. You will appreciate that I spend my entire life catering to your needs, real and imagined. You will recognize that I have placed my life on hold for you, that I have given up all vestiges of the woman I have known myself to be in order to invest in your present and future happiness. But she is enraged with me. It's bewildering and galling. I'm trying to both wash her hair and keep her head from banging into the tub through her spasms of anger. I swear, I hear her telling me that she hates the bath. In fact, she hates me. You're a phony, she tells me. You try and try, but you never get it right. You'll never be right. You'll always be tainted. I find myself actually screaming, "Shut up!" She's yelling too loud herself to hear me. It's taking on operatic proportions, both of us unglued, each infuriated by the other, inflamed by our private injustices. I snatch her out of the tub, half-sudsed, half-washed, soaking the front of my t-shirt. I stomp down the hall and lay her on the changing table, dripping. She stopped crying somewhere along the way, and her eyes are full of something unfamiliar. Fear. She's afraid of me. I wish I could say that stops me. That my own anger whooshes out like the air from a popped balloon. But no. I put a diaper on Sadie's wet ass and lay her in her crib. Then I go to my own room and close the door. I need a time out. Her protests start immediately. She wants me back. She says, "I don't care how you treat me, just don't leave me." And that's when all my anger dissipates. I start shaking and crying. We're twins, Sadie and me. No, we're two molecules who act on each other. Sometimes we make a beautiful compound. Today, we are spontaneously combusting. I'm so sorry, I'm mortified. I know that my movements were brusque, but they couldn't have hurt her. The damage is occurring now, making her think she was bad and that she'll be left. These seconds are hours to her. They might not be memories, but somewhere inside her, they're imprints. Sadie's cries are desperately plaintive. She needs her mommy, pathetically so. I needed my mommy just that way, and she let me down. I remember my mother's emotional absence, the vacuum where a person should have been, the shell. I don't recall an angry presence. I didn't even register that much. I had no molecular influence on my mother. I rush to Sadie's room and lift her from her crib. I'll have to change her sheet. There's a damp, Sadie-shaped spot in the middle, which makes me cry harder. I'm a terrible mother, despite all my efforts, or maybe because of them. Because I stretch myself like a rubber band until I snap. Just like that note said. I keep apologizing, but it doesn't matter. Sadie's body feels boneless as she falls against me. She covers me, from my shoulder to my pelvis. I rub her back. Why does her skin feel so hot when she's in just a diaper? I put my lips to her forehead, and I'm filled with terror. I'm the worst mother in the world. Tragically stupid. All the time she's been fussing, somehow it never occurred to me that she could be sick. I ran through the list of possibilities, hungry, tired, bored, and never once thought sick. She's been remarkably, staggeringly healthy since the day she was born. I've never heard a real cough even, only the occasional sneeze. Now her body is an inferno, and I never even suspected. Where was my maternal instinct?
Melody's right about me. I go to the bathroom to grab the never-before-used rectal thermometer. Shit, I realize we don't have Vaseline. I look around frantically, and my eyes fall on Doug's nightstand, on the optimistically placed Astroglide. I undo the tape on the sides of Sadie's diaper and lay her across my knee, as illustrated in the diagram.
It's okay, pretty girl, I tell her.
She doesn't make a sound, not even when I slide the thermometer in. I can't believe how much I want to hear her cry. She's turned lumpish so quickly. I reattach her diaper and place her on my shoulder, patting her as I call the pediatrician. She's barely conscious. Her temperature is 104.7, but I don't know how long she's had a fever, I say. I field all the doctor's questions, and at the end, he says to take her to the ER at the children's hospital.
I'll call ahead, he adds. They'll be ready for you.
We're an emergency. I call Doug. You need to meet us at the ER, I say. I'm crying again.
I'll be there soon, Doug answers. Don't panic, okay? She'll be fine. Kids get sick.
I swear Sadie's getting hotter by the second, and not just her forehead. It's her whole body. I find myself talking loudly to keep her awake, like they do in movies when someone has a concussion.
Don't fall asleep, I sing out through my tears.
She's not going to die. Kids get sick, that's all. Very few of them die. I strap Sadie into her car seat. She is still frighteningly inactive.
Get mad, I instruct her. Just really let me have it.
Her eyes are uncomprehending. They flicker shut. When we reach a stop sign, I push back the canopy of the car seat. She stares up at me. I've never before seen eyes that are truly glassy, like a doll's. In front of the ER, there's a circular drive, and I leave the car parked there. I don't care if it's ticketed or towed. I need to get Sadie inside, ASAP. I'm panting, holding Sadie against me, feeling her terrible heat. There's a line in front of the check-in window and a ton of people sitting around with their children, but everyone parts for me.
It's a baby,
says one little girl excitedly. The woman behind the window is in scrubs, and I say that our doctor called ahead. She didn't get any call, but she immediately lets me into a fluorescent-lit room with a gurney in the center, wreathed by machines on standby. I must look frantic, or Sadie looks that dire, or that's the protocol with a baby this small. She's just so small. Suddenly, everything is moving very fast. Once Sadie's temperature is taken, the hospital personnel seem to multiply. I think I hear 105.6 and assume that's her temperature, the reason why Sadie is surrounded and I'm shunted aside. They need access to her veins, to her blood. Tests. They're going to run tests and cultures. They need to figure out what's made Sadie so sick so fast. That's what a nurse has just explained to me. I nod convulsively.
Can I get you a chair? She asks. Can I get you tissues?
There's liquid all over my face. I don't know if it's from my eyes or my nose. Sadie is in just her diaper, and she's no longer inert. She's screaming. I step in closer and see her head rolling from side to side. She's looking for me.
I'm here, I say, surging forward into a gap behind the gurney, near the beeping machines.
The nurse pursues me. She's pretty, Indian with a soothing accent. Her scrubs have some sort of cartoon character on them that I don't recognize.
You can touch her. You can give her the pacifier.
She hands it to me. Sadie doesn't like this kind. I stare down at my baby girl helplessly. Wires snake through her nose, providing oxygen. Her head lolls. Her screams continue. She wasn't looking for me after all. She needs someone who can make all this stop. That's not me.
This will help, the nurse says.
She hands me small plastic tubes and shows me how to open them.
Sugar water. Squeeze it into her mouth.
I do.
and Sadie calms for a few seconds. She's able to see me through her tears. I stroke her hair. She's still so hot. We've given her Tylenol, the nurse says, as if she could hear my thoughts. Or did I speak out loud? I suppose they'd be anyone's thoughts with a baby in this situation. She must see this all the time. She sees worse.
She'll start to respond soon.
What if she doesn't?
We've also started antibiotics, the nurse continues. They're taking cultures, some of which won't come back until tomorrow. It might turn out to be viral, but we can't take any chances, so we start the antibiotics immediately, just in case it's a bacterial infection.
Why are there so many people? I choke out. Is that normal?
They're taking good care of her. The doctor will talk to you soon.
The doctor, an older woman wearing a lab coat over a blouse and slacks, is on the phone in the corner. I assume she's talking about Sadie.
Give me a hint, I say. Please.
The nurse casts a glance around. Everyone else is occupied by Sadie's tiny body and even tinier veins. She whispers.
Her blood pressure was unstable at first.
She points to one of the monitors. I can't look.
What does that mean?
I whisper back.
They don't know yet. But she won't be going home for a little while.
I burst into noisy tears.
She has to stay here?
The nurse nods. I lean down and sing into Sadie's ear. I stroke her hair madly. I squirt more sugar into her mouth and it runs out the corners. She chases it with her tongue. Her eyes droop. I think the crying has exhausted her. I don't know what to hope for, crying or no crying, which will mean she's getting better. The doctor hangs up the phone. She appears at my side and leads me away. She introduces herself, and I forget her name immediately.
So she'll be in the PICU overnight, at least.
The PICU? I say through a fog.
The pediatric intensive care unit.
I experience a fresh burst of sobs.
That sounds bad.
No, it's very good. It's where she'll get the most attentive care. Right now, she's getting oxygen, antibiotics, and fluids.
What's wrong with her?
The doctor glances back at Sadie with something like fondness.
I'm glad. I want Sadie to be liked by the people we need to save her life. We don't know what's wrong yet. We need the cultures to come back. She'll be here at least 2 or 3 days, maybe more.
I need Doug to get here. I'm splintering apart. No, I'm snapping. Just like the note said.
Like the note said.
It was a prophecy, and it's coming true.
Someone made it come true.
Her temp is 104.1,
a nurse reports. The doctor gives me a big smile.
That's a good sign, she says. She's responding to the Tylenol.
And her blood pressure? I ask.
It's stabilized for the moment, but we need to keep a close eye. We don't yet know why it was unstable. But let me ask you something. Has she ever had jaundice? It's most common in newborns, but it looks like she has some signs of it now.
I shake my head, no. They don't know what's wrong. Why a child who's been healthy her whole life suddenly gets jaundice and needs intensive care. But I'm afraid that I do. It looked like no one had been in our house, but someone could have been. If someone hurt my daughter, it's all my fault.
Session 80. It's hard for me to come here.
We talk about hard things.
I mean that it's hard for me to sit across from you. I'm really mad at you.
Let's unpack that.
See? That's the kind of thing that makes me mad. The way you talk.
What else are you angry about?
That you call the truth a narrative? That you don't believe me?
I do believe you. I believe that you're being honest in the way you see things.
But you don't believe the things themselves. Admit it. You think it's a narrative. You think it's a lie I tell myself.
Your whole life was ripped apart. You had to tape it all back together somehow.
I see the way you look at me.
How do you think I look at you?
It's not what I think. I know how you look at me. You think I lie to myself. You think I'm in denial.
We've been cutting too close to the bone lately. You've been confronting some uncomfortable truths about what might really have happened and who's truly responsible. Sometimes it's easier to get angry than to confront all the pain that's underneath.
You want him to be a monster, but I don't.
That's not what I want. I want to help you process.
Fuck processing! Listen to me. 8 children. That's what they say. That there had been 8 victims, but only 2 took the stand. What does that tell you?
The trial must have been devastating for you.
We're not talking about me. We're talking about you. About you sitting there judging me.
Let's slow down and figure out where your anger is coming from.
I'm an angry person. Don't you get that by now? Besides, aren't all emotions permissible in this room? Isn't that what you told me in the very beginning?
Is it really me you're upset with? It's okay if it is. I just want to make sure.
It's partly you. It's partly... I went to see him. In prison.
Oh.
That's it? Oh?
I'm surprised.
Surprised I went, or surprised I didn't ask your permission first?
Just surprised you took that step. What happened?
She was my best friend since we were 6 years old, and she betrayed me.
I'm not following you.
No, you can't. No one can.
Let me try.
You know what? I think I'm good now.
Good in what way?
I mean, I think I'm done.
With therapy?
Yeah.
Let's just slow down. We need to unpack this.
No, we don't. This decision has nothing to do with you.
What does it have to do with?
You've helped me a lot. But I'm done here.
Don't walk away, Ellen. Not now.
I got everything I needed from that prison visit. I know what I have to do.
Chapter 22. Ellen.
It seems hard to believe now, but when I first heard about the new neighbors, I was happy. Niels and Ilsa hadn't been any picnic, and I love babies. As far as I'm concerned, the block can always use a newborn. I didn't recognize the name. I mean, there's more than one Katrina in the world, and when she got married, I'm sure she couldn't ditch her maiden name fast enough. So she was well camouflaged. Besides, she's not Katrina anymore. She's Cat, like some sassy little sprite. She looks just the same, though. I'd know her anywhere. She hasn't recognized me, which is both an insult and a blessing. It's also my life plan. New name, new hair color, cosmetic surgery, some colored contacts, and voila. Now I have a new plan. Operation Get Katrina the Hell Out of My Neighborhood. It's not going to be derailed by her daughter being in the hospital, though I do feel bad about that. No one wants to see a baby suffer. But she'll recover. The vast majority of us make it to adulthood, scars and all. Oh, and I have a motto, too. Don't kick Katrina when she's down. Kick her out when she's down. There's no better moment, really. Katrina couldn't be any more vulnerable than she is right now, subject to disorientation and rash decision-making. Sadie will be fine, but she'll be raised somewhere else, so I don't have to look at her mother's face ever again. It won't be easy, though. I was lucky enough to never have an emergency situation on my hands with my own child, and seeing Sadie in any kind of pain, seeing all those other kids... But the thing is, Katrina's misery is only fair. There was a time when I was consumed by the idea of vengeance. I let that go, with difficulty. But I still believe in justice. Word traveled fast about Sadie's illness.